Hello and welcome to Your Homegrown Food. This is a show about all things food, and I'm your host, Jonna. And you are tuned into 101.1 FM again. We're on the air and at freakradio.org on the internet. And on today's show, I am going to play a talk by Vandana Shiva. It is a 1 hour talk, so I will play the first half hour today and the second half hour of the talk on next week's show. So this is the Center for Global Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of California, Irvine, the 17th annual Margolis Lecture, The New Food Wars, Globalization, GMOs, and Biofuels, featuring Vandana Shiva, PhD, Founding Director, Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in New Delhi.
California Irvine and the School of Social Sciences, I'm pleased to welcome you all to the 17th Annual Margolis Lecture. The Margolis Lecture recognizes Dr. Margolis, a founding faculty member of the Center for Global Peace and Conflict Studies and of the Department of Economics. Tonight, we're very honored to host Dr. Vandana Shiva. Dr. Shiva is a physicist, ecologist, activist, editor, and the author of many books. She received the PhD on topics in quantum theory from the University of Western Ontario and then shifted to interdisciplinary research in science, technology, and environmental policy at the Indian Institute of Science and the Indian Institute of Management in Bangalore. In India, she has established Navdhyana, a national movement for biodiversity conservation and farmers' rights, and she is the founding director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, a network of researchers specializing in ecology, health, and sustainability in New Delhi. She has established a school for sustainability, Bija Vidyapith, she'll probably pronounce it correctly later, on the Navdhyana Biodiversity Farm. Her most recent books are Earth Democracy and Water Wars, and her other books include Monocultures of the Mind, The Violence of the Green Revolution, and Stolen Harvest. Dr. Shiva has served as an ecology advisor to the Third World Network, which aims to bring about a fair and ecologically sustainable distribution of resources. And she's also on the board of the International Forum on Globalization and World Future Council. Please join me in greeting Dr. Shiva, who will speak tonight on the new food wars, globalizations, GMOs, and biofuels. Welcome.
I'd like to thank the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies. So I'm happy to be here with you. And when I talk about food wars, I'm not only talking about the 40 countries where there have been riots, because I believe food wars are taking place everywhere, even where there are no riots. And food wars have now become so pervasive that we kind of have created an immunity to see the conflicts at a daily level that are triggered by the way food is produced, processed, and distributed. My lessons in food as a zone of war and agriculture as war really started with 1984. It was really an Orwellian year for us in India. Remember George Orwell, 1984? In June that year, the most sacred shrine of the Sikhs had been invaded by the Indian military. Indira Gandhi had announced that she would take it on, because in Amritsar, in the Gurdwara there, in the Golden Temple, Bhindarwale, a Sikh extremist, was hiding. Punjab had become a land of war in that period. I don't know how many of you remember Kanishka, the airplane that was blown up, flying from Canada to Cork, in blew up over Ireland. In December that year, a tragedy took place in the city of Bhopal, where a gas leaked from a pesticide plant. 3,000 people were killed in that one night. 30,000 have been killed since then. In Punjab, in the violence of Punjab, in those years of the late 70s and early 80s, 30,000 people were killed. So if you add just Bhopal and Punjab together, you have 12 times 9/11. And all of this related very directly to agriculture as war. Interestingly, Punjab is the zone where the Green Revolution was first applied. The package called the Green Revolution was first applied. And the Green Revolution is called the Green Revolution because the architects had thought they were creating an alternative to the Red Revolution, but they did leave a very bloody revolution in Punjab. The Green Revolution was based on chemicals, new seeds designed for chemicals. Very, very centralized management for agriculture, and of course very centralized water management to feed the water for intensive irrigation for chemical farming. The Green Revolution was awarded a Nobel Prize for Peace in, I think it was 1970. Norman Borlaug got it. And Borlaug was given the prize because the idea was, with these new seeds, they were called miracle seeds, and the 12 people that Borlaug sent out to spread these seeds in the world, he called them his apostles. And I always say, this was supposed to be in science. When did it become religion? But it has functioned as religion. These new seeds were supposed to bring prosperity. Prosperity was supposed to bring peace. But peace wasn't the reality of Punjab. And I had been working for the United Nations at that time on conflicts over natural resources in a major program on peace and global transformation. And I had a file of clippings on conflicts over rivers, conflicts over water, conflicts over development questions, natural resource questions. And after 4th of June, all of that disappeared, and it was as if it was a religious conflict. But I knew it wasn't a religious conflict, so I just decided to study it more deeply. And at the end of it, wrote my book called The Violence of the Green Revolution. And it's also around that time I wrote Monocultures of the Mind. Because what I realized watching Punjab, studying Punjab, was actually per acre nutrition output had not increased in Punjab. Punjab had stopped cultivating pulses, and we in India need our dals. Punjab had stopped cultivating oil seeds. It's regional dish is makki ki roti and sarson ka saag, corn bread eaten with mustard greens. You don't find corn in Punjab anymore. It was wiped out. Punjab became a land of Green Revolution wheat in the Rabi season, this winter crop, and then Green Revolution rice in the next season. One monoculture replaced by another monoculture. You see nothing else. The tractorization made sure every tree was cut, every commons was enclosed. And of course, this was a ready-made recipe for breeding pests, non-sustainability. When I did my study in the 80s, 10% of Punjab land was a waterlogged or salt saline desert because of intensive irrigation, and 50% of the soils were diseased and dying. Because you can't do an agriculture where you just keep taking out and taking out and taking out nutrients. And plants need more than nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. They need, like we need trace elements and micronutrients, the soil needs micronutrients, and the plants need micronutrients and trace elements. And they don't come from NPK, they don't come from the urea that came out of the explosives industry. In fact, that's the real food war, I really believe. That the tools for industrial agriculture are tools of warfare. When the wars ended, they were deployed in agriculture. The pesticides were meant to kill, the herbicides were meant to kill, they were just moved, which is why Bhopal killed. Of course, the Green Revolution is being now replaced by what's called the Second Green Revolution. And I find it very interesting that everyone, including our Prime Minister, he repeatedly talks about the Green Revolution has failed. We now need the second Green Revolution. Now, one would imagine there'd be basic intelligence to say, the Green Revolution failed, let's see why it failed, let's not do it again. And instead, there seems to be a human habit to say, if we failed once, just do it more, bigger, faster. And somehow, it'll get a different result. Genetic engineering is the so-called second Green Revolution. And many of you who are students won't remember this. Hopefully some of you who are older might. 1972, in a conference center in Asilomar, the early founders of genetic engineering got together. The people who had worked on how to splice the genes and create recombinant genetic material. They got together and said, we are playing with life, we don't know the consequences, we are going to put a moratorium on our research till we understand this better. That was 1972. Very rapidly, industry started to buy up patents. Molecular biology moved out of universities and public systems into Wall Street. And genetic engineering became a new miracle, except that the difference was the first Green Revolution was deployed through public systems, through national agriculture research systems, through the International Agriculture Research Institutes called the CGIAR system, the Consultative Group on International Agriculture Research. The second Green Revolution is totally deployed by gene giants who used to be chemical giants, who used to Till the 70s, the only reputation of some of these companies was making chemicals for warfare. And today they are our seed sellers. They are determining the beginning of our food chain. Partly because they rushed so fast, they've generated another war around our food system, which is a war around knowledge and war around science. At this point, there's a huge split between molecular biologists who understand the complexity and uncertainty of life at the genetic structure and the genetic engineering industry or biotech industry or the life sciences industry, which is basically saying we know exactly what we are doing and how we manipulate. But if they were that smart, they would be doing what they said. 20 years ago, I was having debates with them and they'd say, these technologies will allow us to grow corn in the Sahara and wheat on the moon. After 20 years, all we have is two traits. Herbicide-resistant crops, so the companies that sell herbicides can now sell us more herbicides. And BT toxin crops. Of course, they don't call them BT toxin crops. They say pest resistance. Herbicide tolerance. The BT toxin crops is the one that has really unleashed tremendous wars. Early research started to show us that when you start to put a toxin into the plant, and now the plant is making its own toxin, you're going to have serious results. The Cornell study showed how BT pollen killed the monarch butterfly. Other research showed how soil microorganisms are impacted. Now, BT cotton is a cotton with this BT gene in it, and its trade name is Bolgard when Monsanto sells it. In 1998, I remember it was, around August, Monsanto put a huge ad in the papers in India saying, by next year, Indian farmers will have this tremendously new miracle seed called Bolgard, which will not be attacked by pests. But I'd been working on this stuff from 1984, so I knew Monsanto, I knew more Bolgard, and I said, it's interesting. They're saying by next year they'll sell it. I rang up the Ministry of Environment. Did they get approvals through you? No, we don't know anything about it. We happen to have a law more advanced than this country does. This country has no law to regulate genetic engineering. We have an Environment Protection Act with a law for the control of genetically engineered organisms and their release into the environment. It was written by the scientists who knew what they were doing. And Monsanto, of course, thought it had walked through the U.S. administration. It was going to walk through the Indian system. It didn't need to seek approval. So I sued them in the courts. And they could not introduce it the next year. They couldn't introduce it till 2002. By 2002, something changed. The very same government which used to work with me to regulate the biotech industry, to negotiate in the international treaties for the biosafety protocol. This is the protocol for biosafety regulation under the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is one of the agreements that came out of the Earth Summit in 1992. I'm starting to feel terribly old talking about all these dates. But that's how old I am. The same government was now, I mean, in March of 2002, they had found some BT crops and had ordered uprooting. They said, this is dangerous. We don't know what it does to the soil. We can't have it growing with all over the place. And they had it uprooted. And within a month, Monsanto had done something. I know in Indonesia, they were caught bribing officials $175,000 for getting approvals. But they did something in between. And they managed to get the approval. So here was the same government I used to work with on regulation. I'm now having to sue them because they've given this approval without any testing. These issues, these food wars continue. And in this food war around genetic engineering, issues have gone all the way to the World Trade Organization. Partly because in the US, they achieved a total deregulation. I don't know how many of you, again, remember someone called Dan Quayle. You're so obsessed with Hillary versus Obama these days. There used to be a guy called Dan Quayle who couldn't spell potato. But they put him in charge of your food system. And he came back, you know, because we managed to achieve this biosafety protocol articles in the Convention on Biological Diversity, Senior President Bush and Quayle came back and said, we're not going to allow this regulation. So they put into U.S. law a principle called substantial equivalence. Just pretend genetically engineered foods and crops are like non-genetically engineered ones. Pretend, don't look, don't see, you'll never find. And that's how you've got unlabeled food. States like Vermont tried to label milk that was produced through injecting genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, the first GM product. The federal government sued the states, said you can't label. And by deliberate policy, the US public has been kept in the dark. In India, what this has basically ended up doing is taking the lives of our farmers. I knew the monopolies would be harmful at the socioeconomic level. I knew the monocultures the GM crops would create would not be very good for sustainability, but I could not have imagined in 1987 that our farmers would start taking their lives because they'd got trapped into these GM seeds. And the GM seeds, people don't, you know, they always say, but why do the farmers choose it? They don't choose it. A video comes into the village, either with a religious epic, Hanumanji of the Ramayana bringing GM crops to deliver the farmer. And according to different regions, they pick the gods of that region. And you know, we've got 330 million of them to choose from. Indians have all kinds of deities. In Punjab, they use Guru Nanak, who's the sixth saint. So they use all this imagery. And an innocent farmer who's always believed in the Ramayana and believed in Guru Nanak Shabds, he's not going to say, I will test the seed. He just buys it. And he doesn't even buy it. He gets it on credit because he doesn't have the money. The seed costs 3,600 rupees a kilogram compared to the zero cost if he used his own seed and 200 rupees per kilogram if he bought it, an alternative. But the alternatives are destroyed. Before you know it, in the market, there's only BT cotton. There's nothing else available. And before you know it, in the farmers' fields, there's nothing else. The companies engage in what they call seed replacement. They encourage farmers to give up their old seed, give them money Why do you have to keep this old seed? And here's this new improved variety. And I have debates with my government all the time about this. I said, you know, seeds are not like dirty clothes that need replacement. Seeds are the very embodiment of evolution. They need protection, they need conservation, and they need the continuation of selection and improvement, but they definitely don't have to be thrown away. So what we have in parts of India now is a seed famine, a land rich in biodiversity, the land that gave rise to 1,500 cotton varieties, 200,000 rice varieties, 1,500 mango varieties. Today, in the area where cotton was domesticated, there's no cotton supply except Monsanto's. Sold through 17 companies who are licensed, who have licenses with them. The farmers can't afford to keep farming. The credit that they have taken to buy the seed and the chemicals, they can't pay back. Because there's another element of the food war, which is linked to international trade. And that is related to the fact that in the early 90s, agribusiness, especially in this country, used huge amounts of subsidies to artificially lower prices. In the US, the cotton subsidy is $4 billion and it goes to a handful of agribusiness farms. But it then allows these companies to sell the cotton at international markets at half the price of the cost of production. And when it's dumped on countries like India or countries in Africa, and it's dumped because the WTO has been another instrument of war, forcing us to remove import restrictions. When these cheap products come in, they undercut our production. The farmer is spending 10 times more for the costs of inputs and earning one third of what they did. And they're squeezed in this negative economy and squeezed in the negative economy with an unpayable debt. They end up drinking, usually 90% of the farmers' suicides are drinking pesticide on the day the creditors come to grab the land. And this has happened in this country, it's just that the scale and the speed is different in India. 200,000 farmers have taken their lives because it's all got squeezed into a decade. It's happened over a century of destruction of the small family farm in this country. There's a book that to me is very similar to my book on the violence of the Green Revolution. It's called Harvest of Rage. And Harvest of Rage is about the Oklahoma bombings. And it's about the anger among the farmers. But it talks also about the fact that farmers are committing suicide. It's just that it's kind of become normalized. We didn't allow it to get normalized. It took 5 years for me to keep saying farmers are committing suicides because of the economic policies, it's because of globalization, it's because of GM seeds. The first 5 years, the government would keep saying, oh, they must have been alcoholics. They must have been adulterers. And beyond a point, that sounded like a very weak excuse. Now the government gives out the numbers. And last year, you might have heard the government in March, they announced a huge bail, which won't work because it's about public debt. But these farmers are not indebted to public banks. They're indebted to the sales agents of the companies. And that debt will never be forgiven by the government because the government doesn't regulate it or control it. Today, the situation is different. And the situation is different only in one way, that while in the early 90s, for agribusiness to get access to international markets, especially low-cost food markets in third world economies, they had to lower the price below our economic price. We live in a rupee economy, someone else lives another economy. People are poor, food has to be affordable, the price stayed at a certain level. And of course, there were other policies, which I'm so proud in India, that were institutionalized after independence, a public distribution system, a universal access to food, remunerative prices for farmers. All of that was one piece by piece broken down either by World Bank Structural Adjustment or by the World Trade Organization rules. The WTO, the first two cases in WTO were against India. One against the fact that we did not have monopolies in seed and medicine, and we should. And the other that we had import restrictions and we should remove them. This second case was a famous case called quantitative restrictions. Before that, governments were allowed to ban imports of artificially cheap products to protect the domestic producers. Well, now that many, many, many places, the agribusiness has made entry, Cargill, ConAgra, maybe I should just mention as an aside, most people don't realize how much influence these companies had in the trade rules that became the World Trade Organization agreements. The patent laws are called trade-related intellectual property rights in the WTO. And the TR comes from the fact that actually intellectual property rights has nothing to do with trade. So they just put TR before IP and said it's trade-related by definition now, just got to have it. And this is where the compulsory patenting of seed, patent monopolies on medicine started. Monsanto has gone on record to say, in shaping this treaty, we were the patient, the diagnostician, and the physician all in one. We defined the problem, we offered the solution, and we showed the way of implementing it, which is bring it to WTO. In the case of the agriculture agreement, which directly affects agriculture and is at the heart of the current food emergency, and I'll just come to how, a senior representative of Cargill was deputed to be the head of agriculture negotiations of the United States government during the Uruguay round of GATT. He went with a government hat. He went as your representative, got the agreement through, and then came back to Cargill. I have called the agreement on agriculture a Cargill agreement. The interesting thing is it has nothing to do with agriculture. It doesn't have a word on soil. It doesn't mention the farmer once. It doesn't say anything about crops. It doesn't say anything about food. It has three subtexts. One is called market access. How do you grab a market? The second is called domestic support. How do you make sure farmers don't get support? And the third is export competition. How do you create subsidies that will be allowed to survive in a WTO? And so much of the subsidy structure comes as incentives.
All right, we'll have to stop there for today. That was Vandana Shiva. Speaking on the new food wars, globalization, GMOs, and biofuels. And I will pick that up again next week on this show, Your Homegrown Food, Wednesday at 11:30 till 12 o'clock. And that's it for today's show. So thank you very much for tuning in. And if you'd like to get any more information about this show, you can check out the show's Facebook page. Go to Facebook, and it's Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook. So now it's time for Democracy Now, and I'll say goodbye and have a good week.